welcome to the Screamcast, episode 94. I am Sean Drager, and with me is Brad Henderson.
Yo, what's up, Sean? How are you?
Good. And driving extremely safely in her car while she's on Skype is BJ Colangelo.
Hey. In my defense, I'm using it like the telephone Skype. I'm not, like, video Skyping
right.
while I'm driving.
Yeah.
That's just crazy.
That would be insane. That would
be ridiculous. And
I'm only breaking one law here. It's fine.
And Brad's turning into a robot. Well, your hand's free, right? Technically, yes.
Turning into a robot.
I mean, hands free, one hand with it against my ear. Who's to say?
I don't know.
Who the fuck is a robot?
You started like doing the whole dial-up sound, you're the Matrix.
Skynetting out.
Yeah.
What about now?
Sound good?
You're perfect.
Sound amazing. Today, Brad and I had the opportunity to talk to Cynthia Sorrell, writer of Black Roses. So we'll be getting to that interview in just a little bit. We are also talking Strangeland and Terror on Tour. But before we get to all that madness,
Captain Howdy.
Oh my gosh. let's find out what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
All right.
Captain Howdy's on my doorstep.
All right. I only had two things this week because I'm in tech right now for a musical. Go figure. which is why I keep falling off the planet for all of you guys, and also why I haven't seen a lot of things. So I'll start with the one movie.
What do you have there, BJ? What do you have?
I have two things. One of them's a rewatch. So I rewatched Cabin in the Woods for my friend's birthday. I haven't watched it in probably about a year. And I love that Chris Hemsworth's Australian accent comes through a lot more in that movie than probably anything else that he's done, which makes sense because it's a pretty early film in his career. It's like right when he started exploding. But God damn, that movie's smart. And every time I watch it, the jokes still land, even though I've heard them all before. The monsters still make me happy every time I see them because it just makes me, it hits all the right buttons. It hits all the nostalgia pulls, but then it's also got a lot of interesting and new ideas. But the one complaint that I still have that I didn't even think was going to be a complaint until I watched the special features on the Blu-ray, which if you haven't, I highly recommend doing it. My one complaint about Cabin in the Woods is the fact that they use Sigourney Weaver as the director. It bothers me. It bothers me so badly because everybody sees them. They're like, oh, it's Ripley. That's a great idea. Ripley is not, like, they're trying to pay homage to the, you know, the Cabin in the Woods subgenre, which would then lead you with a Final Girl type thing. Ripley is not a Final Girl. Ripley is a hero. And there's a difference.
Yes.
And they had a Final Girl on set because Heather Langenkamp worked on the special effects team. Why the fuck did they not just use her? I'm sure she would have been cheaper anyway. She's already there. I don't know why it makes me so mad, but like Sigourney comes out and I'm like, yeah, I know this is great. I see the shot where she steps into frame and I remember seeing it in the theaters and I got to see it in like a critics press screening and everyone collectively like lost their shit all at the same time. But after watching the special features, I'm like, man, Nancy Thompson would have been way fucking cooler.
See, I never even thought about the whole Ripley thing.
That's the only thing that I could ever think of was, and the reason that it stuck into my head that way is because when I saw it at, like, the preview screening or whatever, there was some mouth breather blogger kid who I don't even know how he got a press pass sitting next to me. And when she came out, went, Ripley, under his breath, like a fucking serial killer. And I just remember looking at this kid and being like, oh, that's why they used her. That makes sense. Okay, I get it now. Oh, that, yeah, okay, wow. I got it. But then I went
to the special. I never put that together.
Yeah, which is like a really cool thing because she really is kind of the ultimate American female hero of, you know, the horror genre. But she's not a Final Girl. If you're going to do a Cabin in the Woods movie, use a goddamn Final Girl. And you had one. It's not like, I understand, like, you're not going to be able to get Jamie Lee Curtis because at that point in her career, she was not really doing anything horror-related. But when you have Heather Langenkamp working on your damn movie, come on! That's just me. So I watched that. and the other one I watched was a new one that I hadn't seen, and, oh boy, Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension. Guys, this is a, if there was a way to end a franchise, Ghost Dust, that's the way to end a franchise. Like, we started out this crazy successful thing. How are we going to end it? I got it. CGI dust that turns into CGI tar.
Yeah.
And really unorganized, terribly arranged houses.
Wasn't
stupid
this one...
mustached men and blinking ass Christmas trees. Oh, God.
Wasn't this one
so stupid?
It was in 3D as well, wasn't it?
Yes.
Which makes no sense in a found, you know, this type of
footage. So very glad that I did not watch it in 3D.
Ghost Dimension.
That movie,
in the 3D.
It doesn't make sense, but it would utilize it a little bit. It's because
yes,
of
absolutely.
How they actually set up the camera, because I, for some god unknown fucking reason, they have this high-tech VHS camera.
It makes it's
like,
so stupid. Like, you look at it from the outside, and you're like, oh, I get it. That's like an old-school VHS camera. But all the lenses on it are definitely made in, like, 2015. And then you open it up, and it looks like a fucking flux capacitor inside of it. You're expecting me to believe...
I was expecting Bill Nye to show up and be like, hey, right? Guys, this is how we make a camera.
Right? Like, you look at it, and I'm just like, there's no way that this thing shoots on video. Absolutely not. No way in hell. This is stupid.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I would probably rewatch if I was about 12 deep. Yeah, that's about it. Like, when you can't remember your name and you're hitting on people that might be related to you, that's a good time to watch Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension, because it's the only time it's going to be entertaining, because that movie is a hot-ass mess.
It's crazy the route that they went with it, because the other five are just so fucking normal. Like, there's that time travel thing that they introduced.
And, like, that's kind of cool. Like, and that's the thing that's kind of cool.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I get it. It ties it. Yeah, it ties it all together. Okay, I get that. But the CGI ghost dust. And when I say ghost dust, I mean ghost dust. Like, when you look up and the sunlight is coming through your window and there's little microfibers floating in the air, it's ghost dust. And it's so stupid that it is mind-numbing. And what kills me is that I know that these poor actors got this script and went, oh, my God, I'm going to be in a Paranormal Activity movie. I'm going to make so much bank. My career is going to be set. And this is what they got to be a part of. And I apologize to all of them, because that movie is a nightmare. It is real rough, and I try not to trash things. I really do. But, oh, shit, it is bad. And I really hope that the makers, the creative team, whoever has the control of it at this point goes, you know what, guys? We made about $60 million on that. These movies cost us $12 to make. Oh, let's make another one that doesn't have CGI ghost dust, that isn't in 3D. Maybe bring it back to the basics so we can end on at least a mediocre note instead of that crazy-ass brown note piece of shit that is the Ghost Dimension. That
I think they should have ended on 3. Because I
absolutely.
Think if they would have ended, if they would have ended on 3, it would, because I still consider, people call me crazy, but I consider 3 one of the best horror films in the past, like ghost story wise. Like, I still think that's one of the most terrifying.
It's got some really powerful imagery. 3 really hits a lot. It hits
and
hard.
It's super fucking creepy. It's got a great fucking ending. Like, I think that movie is top notch all the way. And I think, because I really don't think the franchise is that strong. And I honestly, after I watched the second one, I was like, I'm kind of done. Because I kind of know where this is going. I really don't care. So when the third one came out, I pushed it off for the longest time. One night, didn't have anything to do, rented it on Amazon, and I'm like, all right, I'm sleeping with the lights on tonight because I'm really fucking freaked out right now.
Yep. And then
movie seriously creeps me out. But then they fucking ruined it with 4.
They jump shark, man.
Which one was 4? Was that the marked ones?
No, that was, four.
How many is there?
Yeah, 4 picks up.
Things?
6.
God, Jesus, okay.
6 of them. Four picks up after 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
I stopped at 3. 3 was so good that I was like, you know what? I'm done. And I didn't, then I heard, you know, middling things about 4 and then whatever the rest.
See, 5 I didn't actually hate. 5 I actually kind
of
dug.
Yeah, 5 was okay, and the ending of 5 is pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, but 4, man. Whew. But 6, oh, man. Mm. 6 is like, I don't believe in making worst of the year lists, but if I did, that bad boy would come home the prom queen all day.
Yeah, it's definitely not good.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Nice.
Other than that, I watched a lot of wrestling. That's my doorstep.
There you
You're
go.
Welcome.
All right, the first thing I want to talk, I didn't get to watch a whole lot either, but I watched a couple of things. The first one that I watched was Hitman Agent 47.
God, dude,
I'm a huge fan of the video game. This goes back a while. It's like I really love the game, and like the game is so simple.
I'm gonna go to sleep.
And it's a great little premise, but they haven't really nailed the movie version of this character. The last time,
because video games and movies always fucking work out.
Has there ever been didn't suck ass?
I really don't think so.
Maybe the first 2 Resident Evil movies. Maybe part of Silent Hill.
Yeah, parts of Silent Hill.
Resident Evil's not that bad.
But
I mean, I think pretty much everything else kind of blows.
No,
yeah.
I mean,
the original Hitman fucking sucks dick, man.
The game, I replayed the game and it's slow. It's like, it's clunky as hell. But as they get along.
I'm saying the fucking movie.
The movie's horrible. The first one's horrible. The first one is.
It's real bad.
Playing this Hitman. it's that Olga chick's in there. She gets naked, but that's pretty much the only thing worth anything with that film. But this one's like, I'm surprised it got a theatrical release, because this feels like a direct-to-video flick. The lead actor they got he's from a TV show. I don't know who the hell he is.
I can't help you.
Rupert Friend. And apparently he's really good in whatever TV show he's in.
That's right. They did make a sequel to this movie.
Yeah. He's in home. The lead character is in Homeland. He plays the hitman here. Zachary Quinto's in it. So I was like, oh, it can't be that bad with Zachary Quinto. Quinto, whatever. But it can be. The problem is it's written by Skip Woods.
He's responsible for Swordfish.
I believe he's responsible for X-Men, Origins Wolverine, Sabotage, Live Free or Die Hard, and The A-Team. And A Good Day to Die Hard. So he's not the strongest screenwriter.
He knows how to blow shit up.
The only thing saving this movie is there are some pretty inventive action sequences in it. It's an R-rated flick, so it doesn't shy away from the fucking CGI blood. So... at least there's violence there. And a guy gets thrown into a gigantic meat grinder. But the only thing that takes it away from that is they put the Wilhelm scream right there.
Of course they did.
So for what it's worth, I had fun watching it, but I would not recommend it.
Dude, this movie made almost $100 million at the box office.
Did it?
Ridiculous.
Are you serious?
Please tell me that it cost $100 million to make those, so then they made $0.
It looks like it cost them
$35.
Okay.
No, because that means we're going to get more because they made money.
I watched the special features to it, and they were so... I mean, this was on sale for like $8 or $10. I just swooped it up one day.
Yeah, it's the fucking Pompeii.
This is a Pompeii deal.
Gross.
But they're so proud of like... sticking to the hitman roots and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, you guys, the whole story is this hitman goes in, sneaks in, and kills people. You can do one scenario with that. you're following a guy on a hit, and it could be a really fun movie. But they put in all, like, Zachary Quinto's character has, I wrote it down, he is bulletproof because they did some experiments on him, and he has basically metal under his skin.
So I bet he walks super normal, right?
Oh, yeah, it's called subdermal body armor.
This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's so dumb. All right.
Well, to make you feel better, the domestic revenue for this film was only $22
million. Oh, thank God.
It made $60 million overseas.
Of course.
Of course it did.
Yeah.
So roughly about $82 million it made.
God.
Yep.
But, dude, $60 million overseas? Like, who fucking directed this? Anybody?
Somebody. I don't think anybody worth note. Alexander Bach.
Alexander Bach.
This was his first movie.
But there we go.
He's well known for making advertisements. Car commercials, probably. All right, moving along. It's not good, people. I had fun watching it because I have fun with bad movies, but it is not good. Moving along, something that I was not really wanting to watch or kind of, you know, not really in the mood for it because I heard bad reviews, was The Strain TV show.
Oh, okay. Like, did you just start it or you have season two?
I just started. I got the Blu-ray set for like $10 or $15. So I was like, all right, that's the price for me to jump in. And, of course, Guillermo del Toro and Chuck, what's his name? The hell is it? Chuck Hogan. They wrote the books. And I guess there's like 3 books now. And I'm hearing that there's like diminishing returns on the books. But so far, season 1, I'm through episode 4, I fucking love this thing. Like there's some bad CGI, TV CGI here and there. But like I love Guillermo del Toro's interpretation of vampires. This is basically like the same idea with Blade 3, or no, not Blade 3, dear God, Blade 2, the vampires there, where they're like, they don't just have teeth, they go through a biological change, and they're more like parasites, and their mouths open up, and they actually go through these weird physiological changes. So, I mean, I love that aspect in The Strain, that they carry on with that idea of vampires and the virus aspect to it. So, I don't know. I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's gruesome. They don't shy away from the gore, which is great. And, I don't know. I think it's really good. Yeah. So we'll see.
The show's definitely a mixed bag. I don't hate it. I actually think that it's pretty cool. I don't think that it's a show that a lot of audiences are really going to understand. And I think that that's why it's definitely not failing by any means, but I don't think that it has quite the following of something like The Walking Dead or whatever.
But then again, The Walking Dead is god-awful from like half of season 1 and on, in my opinion. And it's like people are going batshit for it. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't really get it either.
So, Brad, what are your thoughts on The Strain? Have you watched it at all?
Oh, I have not watched a single solitary second of that show.
Mm, okay.
I don't really watch television all that much.
Yeah, I'm very choosy when it comes to television, just because I feel like
I've heard it was great.
Yeah, like normally, like I'll get invested with a show, and then they'll string it along. I'll be with it for years, and then it has some bullshit ending, like Lost or something like that, and then it's like all those years just wasted for an unsatisfying ending. I like shows like Sherlock, like the BBC Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch. I like that show, just because I like saying his name. But,
say it again.
Benedict Cumberbatch. That's all you have to say.
I like
his name.
It.
You have to say it with enthusiasm.
I will never say it like that. I'll let you just handle that.
But but I like it when there's, because the Sherlock series, there's a definite, each show is an hour and a half and it's a case, and then you're one and done. But things get carried over through the season. But there's not one gigantic, you know, story. I'm a little bit worried about Game of Thrones. And then it looks like, I thought the new X-Files show, they were going to keep that, do some sort of continuity through the season after the first episode, but no. Now they're in, I don't know. So TVM is a bit frustrating. So, but so far, The Strain, the first four episodes have been really good. So we'll see where it goes. I'm hearing not to, you know, get my hopes up, but we'll go from there. And it got a little bit quiet. BJ did have to step away from us for a second, but that's okay. She'll be back. Brad, what's on your doorstep?
Mine is a little lengthy, but I'll try to be quick. First up is the Isaac Florentine and Scott Atkins jam, Close Range. One of the better direct-to-video action movies I've seen in the past, I don't know, few years. Most of this stuff is kind of garbage that comes out. Yeah. No offense to any of the filmmakers, but they lack a lot. The one thing that lacks in Close Range is a story and a script. However, it's made up greatly for the action and choreography that is throughout the film. And the actual blood and special effects.
Actual squibs?
That look fucking... Yeah, that look fucking great.
There you go.
So that's the one thing. Atkins is a true badass. He's a great action star. If this was something that would have came out, if this pair was together in the 80s, they would have fucking rocked the box offices, and they would have been the all cult classic movies. So I do give it that, because it's kind of in vain of kind of the 80s action flicks. But definitely one of the better, direct-to-video action movies of today. So I would definitely pick it up if it's – yeah, I would definitely watch it. It's a very, very fun movie. Like I said, the action is great. Scott Atkins is – man, his fucking hand-to-hand combat in this movie just is really fucking good.
He's so good, man. So he needs to be in like – he needs to be a leading man in like an action flick. But if he does that, he's just going to get thrown into some bullshit thing. He was in that Hercules movie. One of them, not the Rock one.
He's been in a couple things here or there where has a bigger role. He was in the, I think, Expendables, and you know he pops up every once in a while. I think maybe with his Undisputed Four movie, he'll get some more notoriety. But we'll see.
I hope so.
Next up is the remake of Martyrs. I don't understand. I'm not against remakes. I'm not an anti-remake person. Whenever a remake's announced or a reboot, I'm like, okay, let's see what happens.
Well, there has to be that kind of reason for it, you know?
I don't know if there needs to be really a reason for it. I want to see something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It maybe add something that the original film couldn't do.
Right.
Maybe it didn't go there. Maybe go a different route, but stay true to the source material. Mm-hmm. This movie is just less brutal, less scary, and tries to explain the reasoning behind everything a little bit more than the other film, which, like, then why, like, this is one of those things where you shrug and you're like, why did you remake this film if you're not going to add anything? All they did is take away, which is really frustrating, because the original Martyrs to me is absolutely terrifying.
It's a perfect horror film with the
girl's visions of that other girl that is attacking her. Some of that is some of the scariest imagery and scenes that I've seen in a while. They don't utilize that at all. They have it in this movie, but they don't really, really go into detail or try to scare you with it. The brutality is tuned way down. You only have a couple moments where it's like, oh, but that was in the original film. It's, not all that bad. It's pretty much the same exact movie. Just like almost a PG-13 version of it. Mm. So it was very disappointing. I was hoping that they would enlighten tackle a different storyline, maybe make the friends maybe closer, but they just followed it straight by the book, but just toned everything down, which I didn't understand why they would do that. Next up, I'll be very brief because I don't like to cover movies that we've already talked about. Sean, you spoke about this one. But I just want to give my two cents. Mm-hmm. Watch The Gift. Oh, it is one of the best movies I've seen This movie made me sweaty and nervous and so upset and so happy at the same time. Emotions really run high in this movie, so give it a shot.
Your tweet about it was the best when you said you can't stop sweating or whatever.
What did you think about the ending? That's my question. Also, surprise, I'm back.
Hey,
BJ. Surprise, you're back. I truly love the ending. It's one of the most upsetting and satisfying endings I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, I was so fucking angry, but at the same time, like, I felt okay. But, like, I was still really pissed off. I was like, why, you motherfucker? And then I was like, wait, I kind of get it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's truly upsetting because it gives you that mixed emotions. I mean, it is truly fucked up, but it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know, like, sometimes when you have films with likable villains, sometimes you can justify their actions, and that's really fucked up, but I tend to like that sometimes. Like, one of my all-time favorite villains is Caesar from Sleep Tight. That motherfucker is a piece of shit. But oh my god, how likable is that motherfucker? So, all right. So moving along. Next up, I gave this a second time because I liked it the first time I saw it. I saw it a while ago, and I really really wanted to rewatch it because I did have fun with it. And I still recommend it. You could probably find it on Vudu. You've probably seen it at Best Buy. But Scouts Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. The movie was originally titled Scouts vs. Zombies when I saw it. But, you know, it wants to be like Zombieland. It wants to be that Jesse Eisenberg comedy. It achieves certain things. It's really funny at times. It's got a good cast. It loses its ground a tiny bit throughout the film. But for the most part, it is a very, very fun zombie flick with immature kids fucking killing zombies. It has the montage sequences. It has the gore. It has the boobies. It has the older girl that the, you know, younger kids get, you know, boners for. So definitely something to watch. I think everybody would have a good time. And another film that kind of goes hand in hand, and they were made around the same time, was another film I'm going to talk about, is Freaks of Nature. But that movie didn't really get much play. It got a trailer, and then I remember hearing it that it was at the box office, but then it just kind of disappeared. It has the same tone to it, kind of that purple, yellow, shiny fucking bullshit. It's even the covers of these movies define exactly what they are.
Yeah.
But Freaks of Nature is about humans, zombies, and vampires all living as one. And it's not really said exactly why it's happening, but zombies are kind of, in a way, it's kind of classes are justified. I wish that it went that route because they kind of go there a little bit that, you know, the bottom of the barrel class is the zombies, and then kind of the humans are the middle class, and then the vampires are the higher class. I wish that it did more kind of got a little political, but it wanted to go strictly the comedy route, which I enjoyed too. Aliens show up, some shit goes down, but it's truly a very, very funny movie. I think the comedy kind of falls off maybe about an hour after it. About an hour into the movie, the comedy kind of drops off, but picks slowly back up. But definitely a very fun horror comedy. Both of these, I would definitely recommend, you know, have some friends over, have a few brewskis. I think everybody would have a good time.
Cool.
Yeah,
I was curious next about up Freaks of Nature.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. I would definitely, you're not going to be disappointed.
Cool.
I could tell you that. It depends on how high your standards are. But anyways.
I watched Hitman Agent 47 on purpose, so my standards aren't too high, apparently.
Next up is a rewatch for me. I originally liked this movie when I first saw it, but I watched it again. I wasn't that much of a fan, which that doesn't normally happen to me because the turnaround time was only a few months. But I gave Howl another shot where it's werewolves on a train. I wasn't that big of a fan of it. It felt a little too slow, and I think that I noticed the CGI werewolves a little too much this time around, and it kind of ruined it for me. But definitely worth $10 on Blu-ray. It looks like that's the price of it. Alchemy is releasing this. Alchemy will be probably one of these magnet companies that are coming out because they're releasing some really good shit. They just recently released Hangman, which I tweeted about. That's another film that I highly suggest. I saw it at South by Southwest. That is a creepy fucking found footage movie. And I feel that it tries to be new, but plays it safe, but wants to be overly fucking creepy. And I think the movie achieves that. So, thumbs down on Hal, thumbs up on Hangman. Next up is, man, this movie is so much fucking fun and I'm surprised it didn't get more play. It's, Kevin Bacon and Cop Car.
Oh, Cop Car's so fun.
Yeah, I need to get around to it.
It's so fucking good. It's super fucking basic, and that's why it's so special, is that two kids, little kids, probably between the ages of, what, maybe 8 and 10?
Yeah, they can't be any older than 10.
Yeah, they see a cop car that's unattended. It's not abandoned. It's unattended, and they decide to take it for a spin. And there's something in the car that is very, very special, and the sheriff can't let this secret out. And he spends the entire movie hunting down these kids that stole his cop car. But it's way more than that. And then, like I said, it's super basic, but it's a lot of fun and it's super fucking intense. And it doesn't really have much to go on, but it's just direction, man. Like the director of the film knew to utilize that was like 88 minutes of, you know, just it's super suspenseful. So definitely a lot of fun. It's cheap. I've seen it a few places, Best Buy and Walmart and Movie Stop. It's cheap there, so definitely pick it up. You won't be disappointed. Definitely one of the better movies I've seen this year. And last but not least, I any way, shape, or form pick this up. I'm anti Netflix basically. If you pick up the Blu-ray of Turbo Kid, I don't care if it's the Steelbook to come out. I don't care if it's this limited edition big box Blu-ray set. Yeah, you know what, Sean? You can go straight to hell. So anyways, Turbo Kid is special in many ways and needs to get acknowledged just a tiny bit more because of the piracy that really affected this movie pretty hardcore. And if you're watching on Netflix, it's great. You're spreading the word, but you really probably need to fork over some money for it.
They gave it away on Amazon Prime digitally. Like, the release, it was in theaters, and then Amazon Prime, the day it released in theaters, said, all right, it's up on Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, you can watch it
right.
for free.
It's, there's no excuse.
People are just dicks, what it comes down to.
Is that why they did it to try
people,
to get
They put it on Amazon Prime because they were trying to
combat the piracy.
They're trying to combat the piracy by making it more accessible for people, but people are just assholes. Like, that's just what it comes down to.
So, you know, for a film to actually get, you know, a fairly decent release on Blu-ray after it's been fucking raped basically on fucking torrents and shit, like, it's kind of a shame. You know, this happens every once in a while for these films, and it ends up upsetting because the chances are you're not going to get another film from filmmakers like this, because a lot of unless they make it super independent with their friends, like, no one's going to come to them for money. I don't care how trending it is on Netflix. It's not going to be – they're going to look at the results and be like, hey, your movie made $5. No, you're not going to get anything from us. You're going to have to do this shit independently. It's not going to come easy for these people. So if you want films from, you know, Jason Eisner, from these guys, from the guys that did Coherence, you're not going to get another movie from these people because of piracy.
I feel like this happened. Like, there was a movie called Hunter Prey by this guy named Sandy Colera. And I think that happened to him too, because it, like, all the geeks were looking, because it was a sci-fi, all practical effects flick. It's really good. I have the DVD. And like, the movie was released, and that, but I think it got pirated to shit because it didn't go anywhere. It didn't get a Blu-ray release. It only got the DVD release. And then he did a Kickstarter for his next movie, and he didn't hit his goal, and he just disappeared.
No, he did another goal a couple months ago, and he hit it.
Did he?
Yeah, and he's actually made little action figures for his amphibian stuff. Yeah, okay, I'm actually friends with Sandy.
But it's it's taken him since 2009 to get his next film on the, you know, it's ridiculous.
So, but no, I agree with you. It's those things where they have to go this strict independent route or crowdfunding in order to get their next movie off the ground, because, you know, not every Hollywood story is going to be the Starry Eyes guys where they get Mama 2 or something like that.
Right.
They're fortunate to get something like that. But if, you know, if you want, I mean, we love independent movies because we get to see films that studios aren't attached to. So we get the filmmakers, you know, true voice almost 100%, you know, because, you know, you have friends of friends of friends, producer friends, you know, confidently putting money into these projects because they know that this director's voice is going to be unique. And, you know, think about all the independent movies. You can think about the popular ones like Adam Wingard's getting money to do, you know, some big budget movies. Like I said, you know, the Starry Eyes guys will get, you know, are getting money. You know, probably the Spring guys will probably get, you know, something just because of the popularity of their films. But you got to think about all these fucking independent movies that are, you know, pirated and pirate a lot. I mean, we have the one story of The Battery.
I was just, you know, going to bring that up. Like, it's insane to me.
Yeah, we just talked to them. I mean, you know, I know we didn't go too much into detail on that episode, but I mean, that
they were
was
being gracious. They weren't.
You have everybody talking about your movie, but you don't have anything to show for it. You know, and I'm not saying that they deserve to be fucking, you know, billionaires and quit their job and make movies full time. But when you're struggling in life, you know, on the same time of trying to be a filmmaker, and, you know, you can go on Twitter and Facebook and look at these thousands and thousands of people talking about your movie, but you look at your, you know, what your revenue is for these films and it's basically $0. Like, something's wrong. If you want to continue watching it, like, you could say, oh, man, It Follows is great. Turbo Kid is fantastic. If you want to keep saying those types of things, you might want to start forking over some money, because in 10 years, these indie movies are going to get less and less and less and less.
Well, they're already getting less and less.
True.
We don't even have a mid-range section of movies anymore. There are no more 10 to 15 – you know, million-dollar movies being made. It's either you get a million and under, or you get $100 million and it's a blockbuster. There's nothing in between anymore.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame that it's because just people are dicks. And, like, if you're out there and you're pirating and you're going to try and defend it to me, like, hold your breath. Like, you're a dick, period.
Yeah. And if you have one of those sayings that, like, well, I'm going to buy it if I like it. Well, that doesn't really work. Because, you know, it's on demand for a reason, because results can be seen. You can watch as many Netflix movies as you want, and you can say it's on Netflix and promote it on Netflix. It doesn't really fucking do anything, because those filmmakers, I've spoken to them, they don't know what the fuck is happening on Netflix. They have a thousand people telling them that their movie's great, but they don't see any results from those things.
Yep.
It's trending. The only reason it's trending is because the algorithm for Netflix looks at what you watch and what you like. So the thing that's trending is you know, relation to the films that you watch all the time. If you watch all these horror films, Turbo Kid's going to be number one. Yay. But that doesn't mean anything. You know, if you have Netflix, fucking go to Vudu, fucking rent something, look at the theater, see if it's within 20 miles, go to the theater to see it. You know, I don't care if it's the fucking forest. I don't care if it's the boy. Go see those fucking movies, because if you know, they might not be great, but if you want horror films like that to come to your theater, then fucking support everything. You got to support horror 100%, because that's the only way. You know, you got to give those filmmakers another chance. Maybe The Forest isn't great, but maybe the next film that those people make will be great. I don't know. But you have to support the industry, and you have to support these small little movies, because horror is the one thing that always gets shit on, because there's no really fucking, you know, there's no big awards for it. There's all the Chainsaw Awards and shit like that, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, those are community driven award shows and community driven, you know, advertisements, promotions, all that stuff.
Because it's a community driven genre.
Right.
And like that's how we have to look at it, is that horror has always been fringe, and it's always been, you know, kind of risky, and the only reason that it survives is because of the community of people that are like-minded that also enjoy it. And if we can't work together and, quite frankly, put our money where our mouths are, it's going to go away. Like, and that's just real talk. We're just going to keep
less and less and less.
We're just going to keep getting remakes and installments of shit that we don't like, because they're just going to try and play it safe. We're not going to get originality. And it kills me, because these like ultra, ultra low budget or underground horror stuff that I really enjoy watching, like, these are people that, you know, back in the 80s, their movies would have found an audience and they would have gotten the opportunity to do something bigger and better. But now, because of how saturated the market is and how little money there is, like, the likelihood that any of these people making films are going to ever make a film outside of, you know, shooting in the woods in their, you know, respective hometown regions is so slim. And it's such a shame, because there are so many talented people that are never going to have opportunities because of things like piracy. It all stems back from it, because that's what's taking the money away from everything. And it's ridiculous. It's disgusting, and I hate it. And if you pirate, I hate you. And I hope your kids forget how to read.
Yeah, and if you say I'll wait for Netflix, you can go to hell.
Yep, hate you even worse.
Yeah, because that doesn't really help anything. Because you're paying, what, like $5.99 a month or something?
$7.99, man. Seven. Come on, $7.99.
Oh, whoa. Filmmakers' pants are falling down from all that money.
It's funny, because I always end up buying a movie, and then that the day I buy it, it usually ends up on Netflix, and I'm always like, ah. But, you know.
It's okay, because you supported something.
My money.
You're giving it more money. Yeah, you're giving it a little bit more money, because, you know, yeah, you could watch it on Netflix, but what about that $10 you could have spent and made that sales go up just a little bit more?
Yep. You know what I use Netflix for the most? We watch a lot, like, whenever my wife wants to watch a TV show, she watches using Netflix. But for the kids, like, instead of me going to their cabinet full of movies, I go, check Netflix first. And then I don't have to get out of my chair to grab a movie for them. Because normally it's on Netflix already. So that's great. That works out.
Yeah, I think Netflix is great because it gives the opportunity for people to see movies like Turbo Kid that normally
wouldn't.
Well,
it's another avenue, I think, if you know.
Right. It's not a bad thing, and I don't want to trash Netflix at all, but you need to, you know, you definitely need to think about renting movies and, you know, looking. I'm not telling you to buy every film, but renting it digitally would help wonders. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why it's those – the movies are in theaters, and they're on, Amazon Prime to rent, and they're on Vudu. It's because of that avenue that they want to go down, is like, hey, you can go to the theater or you can rent this here. And the numbers will show. So.
Yep.
But anyways. All right.
All right. Let's jump into our interview with Cynthia Sorrell. She's the screenwriter for Black Roses, And we'll be back after this talking about Terror on Tour and Strangeland. So stick around.
D. Snyder's Strangeland.
Well, today's guest, we're super excited about having her on. We have Cynthia Sorrell, who is the writer of Black Roses, a film that we have talked about these past couple weeks, Brad, quite a bit.
Yes.
She was also involved in the film Rock and Roll Nightmare. So these are two touchstones, in my opinion, of the heavy metal horror subgenre. And we're very pleased to have you with us, Cynthia.
Yay! I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, where do we start? Because you got your start, I guess, in the film, in these films with Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Not
correct?
Really.
No.
No.
How did you get wrapped into this insanity? That's pretty much what we want to know.
That's so funny. Okay, well, I was working under the pseudonym Joyce James, editing basically smut magazine. They had high tone names like Cinema Blue and Adult Cinema Review, but they were basically smut. And I attained quite a following from that and decided one day that I want to direct a movie and that I wanted it to be as crazy as possible and break through all of the barriers between porn and straight films and art films and cult films. I wanted to make something just like that, and I made the film Driller, XXX rated. Porn parody.
Holy shit, you
Michael
did that?
Jackson,
the Michael Jackson
thriller.
Thing.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
It was a world
I fucking
first
love that thing.
Singing, dancing, porn movie with zombies in the graveyard.
Jesus
doing
Christ.
Doing it
that thing
hardcore.
Is so fucking good. And Wild Eye.
Thank
was
you, thank
in,
you.
And releasing that, yeah.
I was insane. And I had an insane and wonderful producer, Timothy Green Beckley, who's a cult icon in himself. And even though I blew his money on Driller, making my fantasy, we're still friends after all these years. So basically, Driller was where I met John Fasano, writer/director/pornographer/producer. And we then teamed up and moved in that way that so many people do, up the sleazy, slimy ladder from porn into soft core horror and then into tamer horror, which really wasn't terribly exploitative, i.e. all the Nightmare movies. Zombie Nightmare, then Rock and Roll Nightmare, and Black Roses.
Nice.
So, yeah, I think it's kind of important to know my history as not just a rock and roll rebel, but as someone who was on, you know, Meet the Press, debating the heads of the National Organization of Women. You know, I was a pro-pornography feminist advocate. And that was not something very typical in the 80s, to say the least. And if you think of Black Roses and the strange messages in there, you can see them as the outgrowth of, the person who was out there campaigning for feminist pornography. Is that crazy enough for
that's,
you?
That's awesome. I mean, it seems around that time, because I was, in 1988, I was 10.
In utero, I'm sure.
I was 10.
In utero,
I'm a little older than that. But I remember around that time because I was starting to get more interested in music, and I was starting to get interested in heavy metal and things like that. And I was raised by very strong, had a very strong Christian upbringing. So my parents,
yeah, I felt that.
My parents were very much involved in like monitoring all the music, very much in the satanic panic. All that stuff. And I remember we had, for a while, they got the TV out of our house because of the, you know, all the negative influences this stuff can bring in.
We got the TV out of our house and the stereo in Black Roses. So you're probably wondering, I wonder if Cynthia is as crazy as my parents. Did she write that movie? People asked me if I believe that rock music is the devil. I have had people ask me straight, and I've even had our greatest fan, Billy LaRock, and shout out to Billy LaRock. I've even had him ask me, please explain to me in a message how you're not aligned with the devil. And I'm like, okay, really?
Well, I feel like Black Roses I feel like it was a response to that, what was going on in the society at the time, with all this stuff, all the censorship.
It was part of my rebellion against the establishment.
That works.
I do not believe that rock music or heavy metal music is of the devil. I don't believe in the Judeo-Christian construct of a devil. In fact, the only devil I believe in is the devil card in the tarot, since I am an adept at tarot and astrology.
Okay.
So no, I would think and certainly thought in the 80s, as did everyone involved with both Rock and Roll Nightmare and with Black Roses, we all thought that those Christian fringe groups who were, you know, trying to censor heavy metal and even rock lyrics and trying to force them to post their lyrics on their album, we all just thought that was insane, you know, because, I mean, I grew up worshiping Patti Smith. Patti Smith is my female icon. And, you know, I consider myself a rock and roll N-word, and I'm out to do as much, I've always been, out to do as much damage to society as possible. And I'm very proud to say that my daughter, comedian, writer, feminist, what else does she do? Oh, and singer, Lucia Fasano, is most certainly burning down the house. Yeah, it runs in the family.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
We are really literally not to be messed with.
Yeah, I was about to say,
quite literally.
As soon as you said driller, I was like, holy shit. I was like, this conversation is going to be completely different from what I imagined.
Yes, you don't know me very well. And
I had no idea that was you. I had no idea.
Actually, this is the first place, and you have the privilege, because I've been asked by three different, I keep forgetting, it's not a blog, a podcast. This is the third request that I've had to reveal that I am, in fact, Joyce James. Joyce James.
I fucking love Driller so much.
Oh, I'm so glad, because to me, Driller is just crazy, and I don't understand why people aren't watching it and just fucking laughing their their pants off.
I saw it.
I mean, I tried with every fiber of my being to make it the most lunatic film.
You did.
I possibly could.
I didn't know I was watching some. I didn't even know I was allowed to see something like that.
Well, if you do rewatch it,
I have a few
times. Opening, if you watch the opening scene where the hot star Michael Jackson guy is dancing on stage, I'm the one in the front stage screaming, "Thriller! He's a Thriller!" and making a fool of myself, and then a big buff bodyguard comes over, picks me up, throws me back into the seat, and screams, "Sit down, lady!" And that was my introduction to my future husband, John Pisano.
Wow.
That was literally the moment we met.
That's awesome.
That's such a special moment for our children. Here, guys, cue up this point in my porn film, and you can see the moment your parents met and where, in fact, your father first touched me when he hauled me down. I have to admit, there's something about a man being able to pick you up and throw you down into a seat that can kind of impress a girl. What can I say?
There are a lot of
cameos throughout our films, and you know, our kids are in our films. My brother, John's sister, you know, my son Jesse is in all of our films. John's best friend from high school, they're all in our films. It's like, really, Black Roses and Rock and Roll Nightmare were family affairs, family and friend affairs.
So
I was part of their fun.
To go back, you did the film Driller, and then
I produced and directed Driller with Timothy Green Beckley. Hi, Tim. No, also known as Mr. UFO, and also known as Mr. Creepy, which Mr. is far Creepy. Less attractive, I would say. But what can I say? Tim is a trick.
So were you hoping to go further into this industry, kind of this rabbit hole of like parody pornography, or were you just wanting to get that out of your system and then came the other films?
I was very interested in incorporating what I felt was erotic. Let's call it, for the sake of what the fuck, let's call it feminist erotica. Now, this wouldn't be, say, Candida Royale's idea. A dear friend, and I'm sorry she passed, but she and I, Joyce James, Candida Royale, no. I mean, I liked really good, gritty, dirty sex. Some people would say, well, that's not feminist. But from my perspective, if it's in my mind, and I've come up with it, and I am a feminist, then it is feminist. Like, whatever, however it seems to someone else, you know, that's how I see it. So I would have liked to inject more, let's just call it, feminist sexuality into both Rock and Roll Nightmare and Black Roses, but I had nothing to do with the script of Rock and Roll Nightmare. And with Black Roses, the expectations were put on us by SGE, Shapiro Glickenhaus Entertainment, that they did not want something left of center. They did not want a Driller. Something that you can watch better when you're tripping. I mean, literally, Driller is a good film to watch when you're tripping. And maybe the same is true of Rock and Roll Nightmare. But Black Roses is a different thing. It's a much more focused,
yeah, it's a different caliber.
Film.
Yeah.
I was actually, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I was actually trying to say something with Black Roses. Where do you want to go with this?
Well,
I can go anywhere.
I felt that you did make, I do feel, because out of everything, all the heavy metal horror films coming from so many things of rebellion, from Satanic Panic, I think Black Roses is one of the films, probably the only film other than maybe Trick or Treat that actually gets that, because Trick or Treat's more or less about obsession and idolizing and then realizing, you know, that. But I think Black Roses is one of those things that is, it does show that rebellion. It shows, it almost makes fun of kind of the Satanic Panic in a way for me.
And I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah. And
time with questions about whether I really believe that there's Satanic Panic. And I think that maybe the dialogue exchange that sort of sums up Cynthia Sorrell's opinion is where Julie Adams is in the gym and she's the head of the, you know, the rights to protect the parents from the children who are, so Julie Adams, who was cast because, of course, she was a woman in Creature from the Black Lagoon, and John Fasano was absolutely obsessed with the creature. So having Julie Adams there was just like the trip of trips. But anyway, that was an aside, but I always find it amusing that that is the case. But, I mean, basically what Julie Adams says, you know, these black roses, they seem to be, you know, really detrimental to our children. And Mayor Farnsworth says, but, you know, honey, there were just as many objections to the Lindy Hop in our day. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's so true. Every single, if you think of Dylan plugs or, you know, Dylan acoustic and then rock and roll Dylan, oh my God. Dylan's got electric. Oh no, the Savior's departed us. That kind of just absolute, that is absolute nonsense.
There's definitely
absolute nonsense.
Yeah, there's definitely, I get the satire, because there's satire in this for sure.
Good. Someone did.
Well, and it's just, I think just because, for me, because I kind of lived through it as being told that this music and these movies will cause me to
get
possessed by demons or exactly like my, I mean, I was taught that this, what happens in Black Roses would happen to me. Right. So watching this unfold,
I'm sorry to have unleashed that on you.
Oh, that's why I love this film. Like these
it
heavy metal
protest point with your parents.
We're past that now.
Well, I'm really glad that you've worked that out.
Yeah, we totally worked that out. We're good. But what I mean, these movies, like, I think we genuinely love these flicks. Like, some people watch these as like, oh, they're so bad, they're good, whatever. But like,
they're
goofy. They're in the 80s, late 80s, early 80s.
For almost infinitesimal budgets. Schedules that were inhuman.
But there's something I think that these movies, especially for me and Brad, like, they touch on something that we genuinely love these flicks. You know, and we're not going to be.
Maybe it's the sense of purity that we went into making them. I mean, with both the, like, you were both kind of wondering what linked Rock and Roll Nightmare to Black Roses. And there's a lot. One was momentum, that Rock and Roll Nightmare and its soundtrack were very popular, so we were able to get funding for another rock and roll horror film, but with a higher budget. With, in fact, a 10 times higher. Black Roses was shot for nearly $500,000, and Black Roses for, depending on who you talk to, but I believe 40, and I was handling the books, $44,000. The only way that either of these films got made and looked as good / bad as they did is because we have a really good family and really smart friends who are very interested in doing a sort of grassroots fun, let's get together and make a horror movie. And with both films, literally, we had friends and family cooking up special effects stuff in their basement, in our basement. The Julie monster was sculpted in my basement. The little boy werewolf appliance that went on my son, Jesse D'Angelo, was done by Frank Dietz in my basement. So literally, our house in Yonkers, New York, became a little, you know, in-house film factory. And, you know, across town, my brother was making chicken monsters that come out of the stove and, oh, chicken monsters that come out of the refrigerator, excuse me, and other goofy monsters that come out of the stove to grab me, by the way, playing the mom in Rock and Roll Nightmare in the opening scene where I'm making eggs and I say, second floor brigade, breakfast is almost ready. And my son Jesse goes, okay, mom, don't scramble the eggs without me. The next thing you know, I've been grabbed by the oven monster who drags me away. And yeah, my son is being made up as a werewolf. His fantasy come true.
There's a great little behind the scenes on the DVD of Rock and Roll Nightmare. You know, creating a child with like this little behind, little featurette. It's fantastic.
Yeah, those are all mine. I hope you know those are all mine.
That's awesome.
So,
as far as the music, I know you wanted to talk about the music.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah, who did the arrangements for the soundtrack for this?
Which one?
For Black Roses, getting like King Cobra, even because King Cobra is half the band, correct? Of Black Roses?
Carmine Appice, also known as Carmine Appice, he is in the band Black Roses, the fake band for the film. And one of his songs, Take It Off, is on the soundtrack album.
But he's also a member of King Cobra, correct?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That's what I was saying, is that some of the members of King Cobra is actually the band members of Black Roses in the film. Only one?
Just
okay.
Carmine Appice. And he was fucking amazing. Oh, my God. He was so happy to be in a horror film playing the drummer. Oh, yeah, he loved that. But when Black Roses, the band, becomes demonic, it's actually our friend Chet Nikelski under the makeup, not Carmine Appice. So I have to, there's so much to say about the music for Black Roses. First, I'll say that since this was really a mom and pop affair, you know, I did the casting for Black Roses and Rock and Roll Nightmare, and cast Sal Viviano as Damien, not only because he's a great actor and he's really, really good looking in just the way that Damien should be, but because he was, and still is, a musical Broadway performer with the world's best fucking voice, right? So wow. I'm like, I cannot believe we found this guy. He's been in Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Wow, we really lucked out. And then our backers go, nope, he can't sing. Sorry, we're going to actually have him dubbed by the producer, meaning the money people producer, not the hands-on producer, Alan Solomon's son. Elliot Solomon is going to dub all of Damien's songs, and also he's going to write all of the songs other than ones he can get from, say, Lizzie Borden, who did Me Against the World, which is a fucking amazing track. I was absolutely devastated. I mean, here we had one of we had a Broadway caliber singer who could really deliver, and he's told, and I'm told, he can't even sing in the movie.
Wow.
So I was not predisposed toward Elliot Solomon. On the other hand, I was asked by Elliot Solomon to tell him what the significance was of the scene where Damien does his smarmy pitch to the parents to convince him that he's really Barry Manilow. And he sings the song called We're on Our Way to Paradise, or My Hometown. And I told him what the song needed to say. And he fucking nailed it. I could not believe it. And when I finally heard the rest of his songs, Rock Invasion, Dance on Fire, those songs, they are amazing. The guy can sing, the guy can arrange, he put together all that music. He's a genius. So, you know, a lot of the popularity for Black Roses and the music really goes to Elliot Solomon, someone I never met.
That's incredible.
It is. And in fact, I've been saying to people recently, do you know Elliot Solomon? I'd really like to thank him, but he seems elusive. So, Elliot, if you hear this, dude, great job.
It's incredible that you never met the guy that contributed the most.
He read the
music of the film. That's,
and he saw the raw footage. And he just got it. I mean, the lyrics, the lyrics to Rock Invasion. When I heard that, I just thought no one could have come up with anything that would be in a better style, that would have better lyrics, that would be more catchy, that would be a better song, that would be more appropriate. If, and then Dance on Fire, good Lord. Praise the goddess. Let me tell you, those songs rock. And we, believe it or not, I mean, this sounds kind of nutty, but my family, meaning, you know, me and my kids, we all own the soundtrack albums to Black Roses and Rock and Roll Nightmare and a lot of albums by John Thor, too. And we play them all the time. We all love that music.
You are in good company because that's what we do. So I've been a fan of the soundtrack and the film since I was little.
We love John Thor. John Thor is like the greatest guy alive. And I have known him for, if I tell you, that would be bad. So I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to say decades. That'll be bad enough. Many. When John Thor was walking around with greyhounds, okay, I knew him.
So, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah. good guy.
Yeah, we had him on the very first entry for this month for heavy metal.
I'm dying to hear it.
Quite the conversation, which he's always been a big part of, you know. But yeah, I listened to his music growing up, and you know, was a fan of the film. But the same thing with Black Roses.
You know what it is about John Thor? And I probably interrupted you, but I
oh no, it's
so
okay.
Excited.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So that was by way of an apology. yeah. So I love John Thor, and really the reason that John Fasano and I both just wanted to get John Thor seen and get his music out there is because he was like we were, and he still is. You know, he is really a humble, nice, caring human being, you know, and what he puts out there is extremely positive. And his song Energy on Rock and Roll Nightmare, I love that song. That's a terrific song. And it's like, even though his act may be kind of wacky and he runs around, you know, acting like Thor, the message of his songs is never violence. It's always healing
right.
through music. Healing through music. And that's where we bonded. You know, so every song on Rock and Roll Nightmare is something positive.
Even if shit's going down.
Yeah, especially if shit's going down. Well, especially if we accept the challenge.
Oh.
That's sort of our family song.
So during after Black Roses was completed, how was because it's hard to find a lot of information for some of these films that are older, trying to
right.
find out kind of the success and kind of what was the reception from the people. Like, was this something that parents got angry over, or how was the release of this film during that time?
Very positive. Black Roses was released with a first-time box cover on VHS, which you may or may not have seen.
And it was bumpy. Yeah, it was the pop-out one.
Yes, it was indeed.
Yeah.
It was indeed bumpy. It could almost be called the Braille cover, VHS cover. It had a bas relief of a guitar and a rose, and it was pretty hot. People just bought it up. There was not a lot of flack over the soundtrack, no. Over the film, I'd say at the time, oddly, which is when we expected flack and actually hoped for flack.
Yeah.
Because being strong believers that all publicity is good publicity. There wasn't a lot of flack, you know. I guess everyone listened to My Hometown and they were suckered in.
Yeah.
To believing that Black Roses really was good for them. Those fools. Those morons. We
What's
suckered
funny is
them
like...
in, and they're now actually all evil. I hate to even say Satanists because I know good Satanists. So there's almost no one you can abuse these days and still be politically correct.
I feel like Black Roses could have operated on both levels, you know, where there's the satirical level that people would get, but then there's also like, well, you know what?
When people are dragged into a speaker, if they don't think we're being satiric, there's something a little wrong, and I'm so sorry that I interrupted you, but I just had to say that was my living room, and the speaker and the speaker that eventually takes Vinnie Pastore of Sopranos fame into the netherworld, that was actually done by cutting into the wall of my living room.
Oh, gosh.
And that is what you call guerrilla filmmaking.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was your question?
I was so taken back. Well, no, I think you answered.
You were taken back.
Just for the release, just kind of how it was received. But I think you answered it its entirety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was actually received pretty well.
It was actually received pretty well. I think people understood that there was no hidden message that was going to be of any damage to anyone, and that, hey, like the parents group sitting in the auditorium and going, Black roses aren't half bad.
Totally. So after Black Roses, with kind of how you guys were dishing out these films left and right, what was next for you guys? Since this was all kind of family oriented, what was coming down the line?
Well, there was one more ultra low budget sort of a horror film, which no one knows about, and the rights are apparently in dispute, and for all I know, it's not even available on, I mean, you can get VHS copies of it, but I don't think no one's gone ahead with it because they don't understand who owns the rights to the DVDs of this very odd film called The Jitters, which was our last foray into low budget horror exploitation.
And some of the best
there's no
makeup
music
effects for,
in it.
Well, great special effects, though. That monster effects are ridiculous.
Yes. It has one of Steve Wang's best special effects, what we call the exploding head effect. And Steve Wang is an underrated master, not just a painter, but a designer. And, you know, we got some of his best work in both Black Roses and in The Jitters. And, you know, for some reason, the film hasn't really caught on, doesn't have much of a following, even though it stars James Hong.
Yeah,
and he seems to have a kind of a following. And I think it's too soft to be considered. It doesn't really fit into any genre. It's a wacky, hopping vampire movie.
Yep.
Yeah, they're vampires who hop.
It is. Now,
I really want to see
what
this.
What
they're called? They're the Gyeongsi, and the Gyeongsi, apparently is a very familiar and deeply entrenched Chinese legend, and there have been a lot of Chinese films made about the Gyeongsi, and they are terrifying. And the difference between them and our vampires is basically they have a yellow sticker over their head.
Yes.
If you
glows.
Pull the yellow sticker off, then the Gyeongsi can go hop around. Yes, they hop, and they can hop great distances. They hop, kind of like Totoro, and then they can bite their next victim. They're really nutty. And so we decided to make this movie, and it did star Sal Viviano, hoping to give him something good to do after not letting him sing in Black Roses. But then John Fasano and I both went to Hollywood, as it goes, and both got involved in making studio films. So, yeah, that was the end of our innocence. Let's put it that way. When you stop making films with your friends and family for fun, you lose innocence, a great deal of it.
Well, just let the listeners know, you can get The Jitters on DVD because I think Fred Olen Ray's company released it on DVD a few years ago.
Oh, yeah?
Oh.
Yeah, I don't believe
That's
it's
cool.
a... Yeah, I don't believe it's like
maybe he owns it then.
Well, Retro Media is Fred Olen Ray's company, and I know that they release it for sure because I have it.
Oh, cool.
So, but
it's pretty lunatic.
It's insane.
I'm in it.
Yes, it is insane. But I love it.
I'm in it. my son Jesse is in it. He's a hopping vampire. He's the littlest hopping vampire. And I'm in one of the last scenes. I play a old woman from Brooklyn buying something in the gift shop. And yeah. So, yeah, wow. I enjoy making my little cameos. But then, as I said, we went to Hollywood, and John became a famous screenwriter and wrote another 48 hours, and that put him on the map. And he wrote Tombstone, and he wrote The Hunchback and The Hunley for TNT. And, you know, he never lost his interest in horror and effects, especially, and Darkness Falls and Alien 3 are probably the films that most satisfied that part of him. For me, and no one can ever believe this, I have almost zero interest in sci-fi or fantasy or monsters. I grew up wanting to be an English professor. I'm a biographer of Edgar Allan Poe. I'm a follower of the decadent movement of the 19th century. You know, I mean, monster movies, Ray Harryhausen. Who are these people? It's like, I had no knowledge of these people, or that it was important to know who Rick Baker was, you know, or I had no idea like what made one special effect better than another, or why anyone would want to watch a movie like The Metaluna Mutant or The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I mean, I had no idea. And, you know, to me, I see it as, you know, it's an obsession. It's a, you know, a certain kind of fetish. And I have many of my own, but those are in it. It's like the films I want to make are about the hidden secrets of Edgar Allan Poe, you know, or biographical. You know, films like Merchant Ivory. Yeah, so it's kind of funny that.
So you moved on from kind of these films, and you started following your path more in literature and things like that. I mean,
yeah,
I know,
and writing novels, biography, and about 20 years ago, I became deeply involved with Edgar Allan Poe. And I have a Poe website called Poe Revealed. It helps to enter my last name, since there are so many Poe websites. But if you enter Sorrell along with Poe Revealed, you're sure to find it.
We'll put it in the show notes for sure, so people can find it. Do you have anything published about Edgar Allan Poe out right now, or is this something you've been compiling?
I've been compiling a lot. I've lectured to the Poe Museum at Richmond, I believe is its most current title, and I lectured there on Poe Day, which was very exciting during the Poe Bicentennial, and I lectured on my extremely contentious views that Poe did have an illegitimate child. So, as usual, I like doing things left of center.
What got you interested in Edgar Allan Poe as far as this level of research and stuff? Was it something you'd always been interested your whole life, or was there something that's kind of sparked that interest?
That's really a good question. Someone came to John. I mean, I've always liked Edgar Allan Poe, but I was never a special fan of his, mostly because of his associations with horror and the fact that I didn't particularly like horror. So I didn't really read much Poe, you know? John Fasano was interested in doing a script about Poe at West Point. And someone, Michael Sipley, who's now an editor for the New York Times, was actually the one who came up with the idea of doing something that was a murder mystery about Poe at West Point. I really, as I said, I had, you know, as much interest in Poe as in any other literary figure, meaning, sure, are you kidding? Great. And I got into it, and I learned all about Poe at West Point, and on, and on, and yeah.
So just kept on going. You started researching it, and you
just couldn't stop.
Just
that tends to be my tendency with pretty much anything. Once I get into it, I pretty much can't stop.
And right. So, what is your passion now? What are you doing? You're a teacher, I recall what you say. What you were saying earlier.
I'm a teacher by training, and by experience. And just sort of by attitude that I think I messaged you, like, for an insight into me, if you know Black Roses, I am Matthew Morehouse. You know, the character of, and I mean, clearly I don't mean I am John Martin, although I did cast John Martin for my own particular reasons, because he looked like Clark Gable. Yes, and I have been obsessed with Clark Gable my entire life. So he could actually put on quite a good Clark Gable, and he was the Marlboro Man. So, yeah, okay.
Yes.
So he became a good hero. And, you know, to cast an English teacher as the good guy who's trying to get people to read, but also who wants to be someone perceived as approachable, who students can come to with their stuff and be able to trust them. You know, it's sort of a bit of self-flattery, like if a lawyer wrote a character who was incredibly sympathetic. So, yeah, I mean, I've always had that very strong desire to teach and to protect kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been of interest to me. And, you know, I am a parent of three. So, you know, I always have kids on my mind of all ages whenever I'm writing.
Speaking of kids, one of, I don't know if you know this, Sean, but one of our, well, I guess, in a way, colleagues, I guess you could say, but James Rocky, who's a bigger blogger writer now, he's actually in Black Roses. He plays one of the students. Yeah.
Oh, he's, you're kidding. Who's at the high school?
Yeah, yeah, he's at the round table when all the kids are talking in the circle.
Oh no!
Yeah,
are you
kidding? I think he's in the red shirt, I believe. The red shirt, yeah. But anyways, he's a friend of mine. He goes to the movie festivals. He's actually one of the, you know, bigger writers out there.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah. So his first and only film, but yeah, he has a little bit part in that film. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's weird, but yeah, it's I just figured I'd interject that because a lot of people know who James Rocky is.
That is
so really interesting. That's cool. I mean, it's cool to be able to talk about these two flicks. I mean, I think, I mean, looking back on like heavy metal movies, Brad, I'm the three movies that really, whenever I think heavy metal horror, I think of Rock and Roll Nightmare, I think of Black Roses, and I think of Trick or Treat. Like, those are the three movies.
Thank you.
So to have two of those movies,
you guys are involved with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And Driller.
Driller. I mean, again, for, you know, you have to think of how hypocritical is a woman who says she's not interested in horror, but made a film that the last scene is zombies fucking in a graveyard. So just how honest am I when I say, yeah, I just sort of got into Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, you know, I think I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about these films. Brad, did you have anything else before we close that you wanted to bring up?
No, but you can buy Driller through Wild's Eye website. Wild Eye released it.
Oh,
yes, I apologize for it in advance, people.
If you want to see Michael Jackson have a huge penis,
it is worth.
That's where you go.
The Driller, as we call him, as opposed to the Michael Jackson guy, the Michael Jackson guy with the enormous squirting werewolf dick. It's worth watching. It's at least worth getting it to fast forward to that scene.
The bedroom scene is something that you can just have on repeat. Because I think it lasts about 30 minutes, and it's the most entertaining thing that you'll probably see. So
it's my favorite. It's my favorite scene. It's my favorite scene in the film. And my other favorite scene is the one that's, maybe I shouldn't say this. The sort of necrophilia scene. Is in the cave with the Gregorian chant. Yeah, I'm also very happy with that scene. That's one scene that I can say I really got everything I wanted as a director. And, you know, I have to say I am a confirmed feminist. To say I am most certainly a feminist. And if someone watches that scene and they think it's degrading to women, fuck them. Fuck them.
Well, this is also Women in Horror Month for us, too. So this is another important thing is that this is Women in Horror.
Yes, I was going to say.
We're hitting two things. We got a twofer here, I guess you could say. Is that a thing? Do people say twofers? Is that a thing?
Well, not hyphen it would probably be better, but, you know.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Writer, producer, lunatic. Certified lunatic. Okay, I'm a definite multi-hyphenate then.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's me. I mean, what you said about, you know, being a feminist but then being involved with these films, you know, with where there is rampant sexuality even in Black Roses. But I think
I'd love to talk about that, but I think we're out of time. We can
free up some time, believe me.
I could tell you in 1 minute about the gratuitous sex in both Rock and Roll Nightmare and Black Roses. Want me to?
Please do.
As quickly as possible?
You can take your time, too.
No need to rush it.
Oh, okay. Well,
we'll sit down for another story. We don't care.
Please sit down. I'll tell you about John Thor in the famous shower scene from Rock and Roll Nightmare. That destroyed his marriage. Yeah, that was a good one. I mean, basically, that was a scene where we just figured we stick John Thor naked in the shower with this woman, Teresa Sturt. She's attractive enough. It's going to be hot. But it wasn't hot. The water, that is, was ice cold because the place we were renting... It didn't have hot water. So they did that scene. I think they were in there 40 minutes in the freezing cold water. Yeah.
At least you don't have to worry about any awkward erections, I guess.
I can get an erection in cold water.
Okay,
this is John Thor we're talking about, okay? Number one. Number two, as I said, this scene contributed to the end of his marriage. So I would not be too sure that nothing popped up, okay? Just saying. Just saying. So we let that run. We just let it run. And as far as I'm concerned, it's three times, four times longer than it needs to be in the film. But both Johns were quite fond of that scene. Yeah. But the gratuitous, there are scenes in both Black Roses and Rock and Roll Nightmare where literally girls arrive at the doorstep, they open the door, and someone goes, "Hello, girls, show us your tits."
Well, in Black Roses, this girl just appears in his bedroom, right?
Actually, my bedroom. In reality. Okay, so this is the way it went in Black Roses. Okay, Julie, you shouldn't be here, Julie. Okay, Julie shows up to seduce Matt Morehouse. She's looking hot, but kind of weird. Suddenly, she has these enormous fangs, which were completely the wrong size, an enormous fuck up, and we use them anyway because what the hell? What the hell? So that girl, Julie, whose name? Karen. I want to say Karen Plankton. I think it was Karen Plankton. She would not. Yeah, she was reluctant to show too much of her bosoms. And we had stunt boobs. We had an assortment of stunt boobs, most of which were not Canadian stunt boobs. Even though these films were made in Canada, the stunt boobs were sneaked in American stunt boobs. And literally, I would contact women. However you did in those days, there was no Craigslist, but basically great opportunity to make very little money in a shot where your face will not be shown, but you can bet your breasts will be. And in some cases, the shots, the color doesn't match. The furniture is my current bureau in my bedroom. In one scene and in another, it's someone's room in Hamilton, Ontario. I mean,
I can tell you, I didn't notice.
If you see, these are reasons to rewatch these films to find all these hidden little Easter egg treasures.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So yeah, we were compelled to supply a certain amount of breasts. And and the same thing with porn, and the same thing with early horror exploitation was every 7 minutes, sex or a fight / blood gore. And we did that. We did that. Yeah. They made us. They handcuffed us.
Well, I feel like, I know for sure that's something that when Roger, if you hear all these stories for Roger Corman, that was definitely on his list. Like every 7-8 minutes, there had to be something going on. And if you were in the school of Roger Corman, so that must have, I don't know when that started, but that did perpetuate for sure through the exploitation.
Yeah,
films.
Well, I don't really know either, but it sounds like maybe he did. But it was also true in porn that you would have 7 minutes of absolute tripe leading up to just a sex scene that's completely gratuitous and made no sense there whatsoever. But it was fun making them, though, because you could say whatever you wanted. You could be as absurd. Yeah. There's a price, not to sound like a political candidate, especially a GOP one, but there is a price to pay for liberty, those, some of the old films, I had the liberty to do and say a lot of things that were really nose-bumming and fun. And when you get into the Hollywood system, all your creativity and your, all the difference, let's say, in your perspective, it's all just rubbed out of you. You know, that you're reduced to being a box. You know,
right.
You have to fit in the box. You may not exit the box. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so thrilled that people are still watching Rock and Roll Nightmare and Black Roses, and they are my family's home movies. We watch them and we go, oh, look at Uncle Jim playing Stig. He's so cute. And it's like, people, stop abusing my brother, Jim Sorrell, over his Australian accent in Rock and Roll Nightmare. He was trying to do a bad Australian accent. That was the idea. And then people complain that he suddenly loses his accent like he forgot. And no, that was the point, was that when Stig became evil, he got an American accent. That was to show how evil he had become. He no longer had a bad Australian accent. So, you know, say what you want, but don't be mocking on my bro, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, enjoy films. Don't rip them apart. Just sit back and enjoy, especially these films.
I mean, literally all together, you know, like a family for a week, you know, living on Campbell's soup and tuna fish combined to survive. We're just a big family trying to make a little movie.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, these movies are going to be around for quite some time. I mean, people are going to be rediscovering these every year, and we definitely spread the word about these films every year. I feel like I do. I feel like every year I'm talking about these movies.
We talk about these movies.
You're all the best.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
You're all the best.
Well, Cynthia,
this is a rock invasion.
Yeah, hell yes. Cynthia, thank you so much for taking the time and talking to us about these films. Like we are fans, and we do love the films, and like I said, I hope more and more people continue to rediscover these.
Me too. And anyone you need or want to contact, you know, to do a podcast or to refer you to someone else, you know where to find me.
We'll do. Right. Thank you.
Right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you guys can hit me up on Facebook under my actual real name, Cynthia Sorrell. And I will answer.
I will do that. Yeah, definitely.
Too.
Awesome.
I'm just that kind of person. Where I really, really appreciate everyone who watches these films. I am like just thrilled every time I hear something. I just hear someone watched one of them, and I just smile and basically shake my head, but in wonder. It's been a long time coming. But it's nice.
Oh, man.
Well, we appreciate it. Yeah, and you know, the films are having a resurgence every once in a while, and it's nice to see. And that's exactly why we're doing this month, is because with Sean and myself, these films are very important, especially for me growing up, because it got me into a different type of music, and you know, I always enjoyed them. So it's nice to actually have, you know, Thor came on prior, and then you. So it's all coming together nicely. So
I'm so glad. That's
you're in good company.
I want to give you a hug.
Internet hugs.
I'm giving you virtual
all
hugs. Okay. Virtual hugs for everybody.
Day, your story.
right. Well, that was our interview with Cynthia Sorrell, writer of Black Roses. A favorite of ours, that flick. BJ.
And the director of Driller.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Director of Driller.
Yes.
BJ, I need to ask you, what are your thoughts on Black Roses in general, the flick?
In general, I think it's fun. I think that it's a little wacky. that's putting it, you know, nicely. I'm really bummed that I couldn't hear the interview because from what you told me, I guess she was kind of a trip and a half and
a lot of fun.
Yeah. I think probably the thing I like the most about Black Roses though is probably just like that facial piece, that monster effect piece.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous. Like, it reminds me of something that probably came out of the same shop that made whatever was made for the Super Mario Brothers. Like,
so
that
they were doing all those like in their house. Right, Brad?
Yeah.
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 That's probably also correct.
Yeah.
I think it can get a little repetitive at moments, but I think it's fun. I mean, I like all of the heavy metal movies that we're talking about. I think that they're all, at the very least, they're all fun.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's jump into our segments here. Let's kick things off with Stream Screams.
Nate, wake up!
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
Don't fucking scream at me!
Scream, I'll break your neck.
Don't scream, miss. Don't scream.
We are talking Dee Snider's Strangeland.
Oh, yeah.
TM.
Here we go.
In this small town.
Check this guy out.
On this quiet street.
Now we can talk to him one-on-one.
An unspeakable evil is stalking the net.
What kind of name is Captain Howdy?
He found a series of symmetrically placed puncture wounds.
To use torture.
Welcome to my world, Detective.
Pain is a uniquely personal experience.
Oh, God, please don't let this be happening.
My badges are forever.
My badge represents the law.
I'll kill him.
Trust me.
That's better.
There's nowhere to run.
Daddy!
There's no place to hide.
Find me.
He's got this town wired.
Ah! Gotta love this technology.
Kevin Gage.
Ready to come in?
Elizabeth Peña.
What have you done with my daughter?
Robert Englund.
Somebody's gotta take that boy out.
Dee Snider.
So much flesh, so little time.
The hunt has begun.
Wanna play ball, Scarecrow?
Strangeland.
Written by Dee Snider.
Yes.
Directed by
somebody that never really worked again.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what's
the guy's name?
John Piplow? Piplow?
Yep. Never heard that name ever.
It was not recognizable. Starring Dee Snider. Of
course. And Linda Cardellini. Let's be real here.
Yes. And Amy Smart.
Yeah. Baby Amy Smart.
And Kevin Gage.
Robert
who
Englund.
Always plays the best badass. Yeah, Robert Englund.
I would say England. Englund. Horrible.
I say Englund. I don't know if any of us
I think it's Englund. I think it is. Anyway, what a movie. I just finished watching this, and I'm still processing it.
Wait, is this your first time?
This was my first time seeing it. I, like everyone else, missed this
man.
In 1998.
Oh.
I did not miss this in 1998.
I definitely recognize the cover from the video store, and it's something that I always kind of, because it looked direct to video to me. You know, Dee Snider's Strangeland looked like direct to video horror, and at the time I was in my, I'm going to college and I'm only going to watch, like, you know, elite things and blah, blah, blah. I was a bit of a snob.
You were a Criterion asshole.
Yes, I was. Yep. So I, of course I was like, would go past this and, you know, maybe someday I'll watch it, but I never saw it. The structure of the film struck me because, you know, it's set up as this kind of 90s techno thriller chat room horror, But really, the chat room stuff is a very small part of the film. But I was expecting it to be, you know, like Seven or something like that with chat rooms. And thankfully, it kind of makes a turn halfway through the film and becomes a little more than that. And I don't want to give any spoilers. So I really think people should check this out because it
people
did.
Have.
If they haven't, if they're like
I think
me,
you're
and
alone
haven't.
On this.
Am I alone?
I don't know, man. I think this is something that definitely found its audience
did it?
When
okay.
it hit VHS.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it definitely had a limited release, but it was promoted like on MTV and like the promotion for this film was a lot. Like
okay.
I remember seeing trailers, but it didn't open wide. It opened very, very small from what I can remember. And it didn't even come around. Like I had to wait until it hit VHS to actually rent it at Blockbuster.
Okay. Well, this is like the heyday of body art, body modification.
BME Zine was just killing it, man.
Yeah. so it makes sense. Okay, so if I'm the only one who hasn't seen, then fine.
No. I think there's still an amount because I think, like you, I think it really didn't have a target audience because I think it wanted to play to the horror crowd. It wanted to play the, oh, your child's going to get abducted from a chat room.
Mm-hmm.
Type craze because that was actually happening.
Yeah.
You know, so it tried to play so many different notes, and it does that in the movie too. And I think that's kind of what hurt the movie because I honestly think this could have been like I don't want to see a 3-hour movie of Strangeland, but it felt like it should have been because it's so rushed.
It almost felt it felt episodic. The structure feels very episodic.
It feels like, you know, it should have been split up into, you know, Snyder's sequel that he, you know, has always intended to do, but never got a green light for it. But I think that's kind of what hurt it because storytelling wise, the reason why it didn't do well in critics is because of that rush, having that direct-to-video feel, having that, you know, Cold Chamber, Bile soundtrack.
Yeah.
Bile's the band, by the way. I didn't name Bile's like in Chip. You know, Soulfly. Because Bile's like, that when they come on stage in that movie, I'm like, yes. I still like sit there and I'm like, uh-huh, yeah. But, you know, the kind of that, it was that new metal sound that was kind of coming out of the woodwork, you know, from all these different directions. So it really was the movie of the times of that setting and that exact time. And that time was so short, it passed, and then no one gave a fuck anymore. Because it was like it was advertised like on MTV, and people were like, yeah. And then next month it was like, no, nu metal sucks. We don't want that movie. You know, I feel that's kind of what happened. It was like, what the fuck is a chat room anymore? You know, it seemed like it was, you know, thought about and played to that crowd just for a very short time and missed its window.
Mm-hmm.
It was made at the right time, but I think that window passed so quickly that people just kind of laughed and was like, who would do that in a chat room? Who would go somewhere?
When you're absolutely
when did
right.
MySpace start up? I feel like this, it kind of, like,
MySpace.
Chat rooms. Well, because it was like chat rooms and MySpace went up, then everyone went to MySpace and things like that.
MySpace was in the 2000s? It was in the 2000s, okay. But you had a couple more years for that. Like,
yeah,
trying to think like when chat rooms died out.
Yeah, because Strangeland, you got to think, is 1998.
Yeah.
Chat rooms died out when dial-up kind of passed.
Yeah.
Around that time. Because, the AOL days. That was kind of the chat room time, was the AOL days. And once AOL kind of passed, like, I mean, people still use AOL, like for email, which I always laugh when people have AOL email addresses. But, you know, I think that was kind of around that time is like maybe 98, 99, the chat room craze kind of fell through because we got Instant Messenger instead, you know, and we had AOL Instant Messenger, and that kind of took place over chat rooms.
Because
what
kind of happened with the chat room thing too as well is that it also had to deal with the accessibility of the internet. Not everybody had it. so you didn't have the availability to talk to all of your friends
right.
all the time. So you talked to who you had available, which meant chat rooms. So then right. when the internet became more accessible and you had all of your friends, you know, that kind of took away the, you know, scary, scary online predator world because you weren't talking to strangers anymore. You were talking to people you actually knew,
yeah.
which is why it always cracks me up whenever I see these ads now for like scary people on Facebook that are trying to get your kids. You have to use your real fucking name.
Yeah.
Like that isn't real. Like it, obviously it's still an issue. It's, you know, it's still a thing.
It's a bit
harder.
They have to jump through a lot of hoops.
Yeah, it's not as easy to, like, be a creep on the internet as it used to be.
Twitter, on the other hand, you can be a fucking creep on Twitter.
Yeah, you can be a creep on Twitter. Twitter and Instagram.
And Instagram.
Oh, God, yeah. And
I stay away from Snapchat.
Snapchat's really fun, though. It's super
Captain
fun.
Captain Howdy wouldn't stay away from
no,
Snapchat.
No, Captain
yeah,
Howdy would
you
not.
Yeah, pictures of pierced dicks.
So, but, I mean, I still like the film because, you know, it does play a big part in nostalgia. Watching Dee Snider play a serial killer is one of a kind. You don't really get that
yeah.
kind of entertainment these days. Linda Cardellini, she is just super fucking cute all the time, whether it's Freaks and Geeks or she's playing Daphne in Scooby-Doo. She is always super adorable. And, you know, for nostalgia purposes, I still enjoy some of that soundtrack.
Yeah.
I wouldn't listen to it very much, but, you know, when it comes on, I'm like, oh, man, I remember that song. I remember liking Vile, you know? But I don't know. I think the film does have something to offer, but it does have that, you know, USA direct-to-video, you know, feel to it. I do agree with that.
Yeah. It was fun. I had fun with it, though.
I had a lot of fun with it. I think that it's a very misunderstood film. I think people get too caught up in the idea of kind of how dated it is. You know, you mentioned MySpace earlier. Like, I feel that way whenever I watch Superbad and he makes the MySpace joke, and I'm just like, oh, God. And I think people do that with Strangeland as they look back at it, or, you know, just to some extent, any of those late 90s, early 2000s films that did anything with the internet, like Fear.com yeah. or even Urban Legends, like, because, you know, Danielle Harris's whole character is, you know, the cyber goth.
Right.
And I think people see that and they get caught up in that, and then that whole kind of subgenre of the body mod thing, like, there's really not a lot of body modification horror. Like, Strangeland, American Mary, and those are, mm-hmm. to be completely honest, the two that I immediately think of
yeah.
off the top of my head. The rest of it I'd have to look up, but
I think this one does, like, this handles the technology, like, they don't try to future it up. You know what I mean? It's what it was
no, it's
at
very
the time.
Basic.
And it's very
yeah.
basic. And even his video is all choppy, and it looks, it's not like, what was the movie we talked about last week? Oh, Turbulence 3,
Turbulence.
Where they're somehow broadcasting and everyone is able to see in fluid video. Like, this one, it at least keeps the technology current to the time. So it almost could be, you know, a period piece.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 20 years from now.
But it also doesn't go into super detail. Like,
right.
they don't show them signing into a chat room. It's, you know, very brief because, you know, at that point in time, it was, you know, not everybody had the internet, like BJ
yeah.
said. So there are those times where, you know, it has to be explained. You know, when she's like, oh, there's a chat room, you can click on a member's profile.
Yeah.
Now we're sitting there watching it like,
that's
no
funny.
Shit.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I
we've all seen
time,
Catfish. We know how this
yeah,
goes down.
Right.
Yeah, it had to be explained just a little bit better.
That's funny. I feel like they explained body modification more than chat rooms, though, in this one. You know that scene where this
yeah,
guy's
absolutely.
Like,
I think that's
the ambulance driver.
The smart route. Because I think at a time, you know, you have to, like, as a filmmaker, you know, and that's why I kind of really hate when movies acknowledge pop culture.
Because
mm-hmm. it's like, when you mention LiveJournal, when you mention MySpace, when you're mentioning Facebook, dude, this shit is gonna go away.
Oh, I just dated our show. I'm sorry.
Huh?
I just dated our show. I apologize. Those of you listening 20 years from now.
Well, no, you do that. And I think that was the smart thing that, you know, Strangeland did, is they didn't go into detail of where they're going or right. what, you know, website they're using. They just used chat rooms and instant messenger. And we'll always have instant messenger because we have text messaging. So yep. it's easily relatable. Text messaging is never going to go away. Facebook, more than likely. MySpace, already kind of gone. You know,
it's gone.
It's one of those, huh?
Oh, it's gone. MySpace.
No, no,
gone.
I'm saying that's just the nature of the social media beast. But I think with Dee Snider, with this, they played it really smart because they didn't reference it all that much. And like I said, they crammed this 3-hour movie into like an hour and a half. And I don't think they really – and another thing that's the reason why it kind of hurt the film, because they don't go into detail on a lot of things.
Well, yeah, because there's three definite pieces to this film. There's the beginning chat room stuff. There's the rehabilitation stuff. And then there's the after, you know, with the neighborhood people and then with the detective. You know, there's like three distinct storylines going on in this film.
Yeah, and it moves incredibly fast.
Yeah, there's one point where I was like, I'm like, this person got kidnapped again? Like, when did that happen? You blink and, like, somebody's gone.
Because they do the build-up, and then he discovers. And I think the discovery works at an appropriate time, but it feels like the rehabilitation should have lasted a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And then him coming back and, you know, terrorizing these people... That feels like another movie.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying this is a great idea or a great story that could have spawned, you know, a series, but I kind of wish that it did, because I feel that if it did that route and maybe took its time, it would be more talked about and more loved.
Mm-hmm.
So.
If it was like an HBO miniseries.
HBO miniseries. Could have been, because,
well, they have to get away from the gore and stuff and the nudity, you know. Or Showtime. Probably more Showtime.
Yeah.
I don't think. This is a Showtime.
But I don't know. Give it a shot. It's on DVD from Lionsgate. It's on Vudu. You can rent it on there.
It looked really good,
so
man.
Anyways.
I watched the HD.
It looks. Yeah, it looks better than most of the shit that's out there.
Yeah.
So, I would definitely give it a shot.
Absolutely. Captain Howdy is such a cool character.
Yeah, and Dee Snider does a decent job. There's a couple moments where his lines, like, it's a little too philosophical sometimes. But, you know, he is a fun character. He'll go on his rants, and I don't think Dee Snider is cut out for kind of the monologue. Driven things, but like, you know, his obvious kind of like, you know, his one-liners that he does that he references Freddy Krueger a few times throughout the film. I think that's a lot of fun because, I mean, obviously it's one of his inspirations, and he has, you know, Robert Englund in the film.
What do you think of Robert Englund's character in this movie?
I mean, he plays Robert Englund. Anytime Robert Englund is out of the Freddy makeup, he plays like the crazed redneck.
Yeah.
Yep. Paper Brigade, so, man, all day.
Yeah. It works.
I love but, the scene know, where he's just, watching like, TV they're... and his wife walks in and she's kind of weirdly dancing. That seems great.
Oh, no, it's great. But how about, like, that's the thing, is there's more substance to that even scene, because you have this guy who is so afraid of, you know, kids being kidnapped and tortured, but he's obviously watching some kind of child pornography.
Yeah, he's watching more of a violent, rapish porn.
Yeah, like a snuff film. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's definitely a rapey porno. But it's like he's sitting there in his fucking, you know, boots and his legs spread with his tidy whiteys. And it's like, at that point in time, you're like, man, I really hope, you know, fucking Captain Howdy comes back now. Yeah. Like, there is that kind of turn of events where you kind of feel bad for him.
Oh, yeah.
At
yeah.
one split second, you do feel bad for him. And that's why I think the film would have been so much better if they did take it a little bit slower and made the film a little bit longer to kind of, you know, dive into that. Because I there could have been the justification, but it happens so quick. You're like, oh, of course I want Captain Howdy, you know, to die. Right. Or, you know, I don't want to see this creep because he's an awful, awful person. And he is. But it's fun when they try to make you feel sympathy for the character. So, and then plus, like BJ said, he's super fun. Like when he's fucking hanging from the tree and he falls down and he says, "What a rush." You know, it's just like that line alone. I just, you know, That's the reason. Those are the types of reasons I love Strangeland. TM. Yeah. You gotta say TM, I think.
TM.
Or D. Snyder will sue us.
All right.
So,
BJ, do you think it should have been a longer property of some sort in some way?
I think that it should have. I think that it would have been more interesting as like a television series, and it just followed kind of like
totally
Captain Howdy and like the different people that he interacted with and like found, you know. Yeah. I think it would have been really beneficial. And but at the same time though, like that never would have worked in 1998. It would be like, because there just really wasn't the audience for that sort of a thing.
It would work now for sure.
Yeah, it would work now, but now like it would have to be, unfortunately, like a chat roulette kind of bullshit, and it'd be like video chat, which I don't think. I mean, as much as I like movies like Unfriended or The Den, I think that they're really cool. There's something so much more sinister to not being able to see who you're talking to.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And that,
There is a sequel, a prequel that Dee Snider did for the Scream Factory line of comic books. He released a prequel. I forget the name of it now. But anyways, I did read that. I don't know. That feels like maybe 10 years ago. But, you know, it kind of – he was – it won – he forgot the time period that Strangeland was released. That's kind of what it felt like. It's like you do realize you made this in 1998. You're not writing this like in 2008 now. So, anyways. But I would definitely pick up the film if you haven't seen it. It's one of the better 90s horror films out there, but that's also not saying much. Like, it's not great. That's the thing. It's not fucking great or anything. It's just a lot of fucking fun.
Yeah, it's good. It's solid.
Yeah, so anyways.
It was the best thing I watched today. Second to, you know, it's better than Hitman Agent 47.
And there are a lot of things in this world that are better than Hitman Agent 47.
There are. All right, let's... move into our next segment here. Before we do that, though, we had asked you on Jog, J-O-G-G, Google that shit, download the app, and follow links when we tweet them out. I got to figure, like, I like the idea. I'm not sure if it's working. I'm into week number 3 here, and we got, like, 2 replies, and they're both the exact same fucking thing. The exact same soundtrack. My question was, what is your favorite heavy metal soundtrack? I'm only going to play one of them because the other one gets cut off and he seconds this one. So this is Thomas Miles telling us his favorite heavy metal horror soundtrack.
My favorite heavy metal soundtrack would have to be The Crow from 1994. It has bands such as Pantera, Rollins Band, The Cure, Nine Inch Nails, Rage Against the Machine. Amazing bands came out at a amazing time for music, and just an all around great soundtrack.
And that's it. And then Jordan Carey comes in and says, "The Crow, come on, people." I'm frustrated with this Jog thing.
It's because no one wants to be on video.
I know. Well, I'm going to see if there's something else where we can pose a question and get audio responses. I mean, there's got to be something else easier than this, because I think everyone's trying to download the app and everyone's trying to reply. And then we had I know 2 people for sure that tried to reply and the damn thing didn't work. So, well, I'm going to figure something out for next week or next time. I like the idea of including our listeners on the show like this. I just got to find a better way to do it. So I'm still experimenting. But I said my favorite soundtrack was Trick or Treat for Heavy Metal Horror because that's like the first one that I bought. But what about you guys? What are you have a favorite heavy metal horror soundtrack, Brad? Or BJ?
The Crow.
You suck.
I don't know. Like, The Crow's great, but that's definitely more industrial than it.
Yeah.
Like, it does have Pantera and Rage Against the Machine, but that fucking soundtrack to me feels like pure industrial, like, 90s.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it does have those types of metal songs, but that music doesn't really play in the movie all that much. It's mostly, like, Nine Inch Nails and, like, The Cure and shit like that, so. But anyways, I mean, as far as heavy metal soundtracks go, I would be right there with you with Trick or Treat.
Yeah.
I think Fastway's entire album they did dedicated to Trick or Treat is fantastic. It has, you know, it's specifically made for the film as well. So you have, you know, you have that teenage angst in there. You have, you know, depression. You have the violence. You have that kind of feel good rock music at the same time. Mm-hmm. Which, talking about feel good rock music, I think the highest point in Strangeland is when that movie ends with Twisted Sister's Heroes, the hero song. I forget the name of the title now. What is it? Heroes Never Die or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
But anyways, side note. But I think Trick or Treat's one of the better soundtracks.
How about you, BJ?
I've got two that I really like.
Whoa.
Oh, okay. I know, right?
Settle down.
Okay. So it's kind of a cheat, but I really don't care. I really, really like the soundtrack to Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, because I really like Dokken.
Yeah, Dokken.
So that's always going to be up there for me 100%. And then the one that's more of a cheat than anything is Kiss Meets Phantom of the Park, because they horrendously lip-sync all of their hits. It's, oh man, the lip-syncing's really off, but I also am I'm pretty ride or die for Kiss. It's kind of unhealthy. In terms of my love of metal, I like my glam rock, I like my teased hair, I like my men in leather spandex and sequins. That's the metal that I like. I love it so much. I proudly own Whitesnake concert VHS tapes. I don't give a fuck.
Hell yeah.
I love it.
Kidding me?
I
like my men in spandex and sequins too.
Yeah. I can't help it. That's always what I've loved. So those are my two favorites.
Awesome. Very cool. Speaking of Kiss, let's move into our VHS. Oh my God.
Well, here we are at last. Right where we ought to be. Video.
Oh my God!
Terror on Tour, people. 1981. Is this 81 or 80?
80.
They play at murder.
Terror on Tour.
The group makes real music and make-believe death.
I wonder what would happen if we threw a real body in. All cut up, real blood.
Where's my $50?
Until suddenly, their fantasy becomes real.
Give it to me, give it to me now.
I wish that this movie would have been made a few years later so that it would have been, like, in the heart of the glam metal phase, because it would have been a totally different film. But because it wasn't, it was, like, a precursor to the glam metal, we got, like, Wannabe Kiss, which I'm not complaining about. But
well, you got a slasher film rather than kind of a heavy metal, you know, horror film. The thing is, this movie is very, very, very standard slasher.
Yeah,
it's just set at a concert.
We didn't say what it was called,
or is it a tour?
We didn't say what it was called.
Yeah, I said Terror on Tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just like you said,
Terror on Tour.
Terror on Tour. Directed by Don Edmonds.
I don't know who that is. Who is that?
What did he do?
He was an actor, and then he did some directing.
Oh, he did. Did he?
Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS.
Everything makes so much more sense now.
Wild Honey.
Okay. Yeah.
Southern Double Cross. Okay. And then the Ilsa, harem keeper of the oil sheiks.
And yeah, you could say just Ilsa.
Yeah, you don't say Ilsa. Ilsa.
Have you never seen any of the Ilsa movies?
No, Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS was on someone. There was like a German Blu-ray that I almost bought, but it was like almost $40, but the cover was amazing. But I want to see it really bad. I need to, you know, I was going through my Nazi exploitation, and someone was like, show me the cover of her, and like, oh God, what
she's
a cover.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Erotic. There's Ilsa, the Tigress of Siberia too. That's the cover that I saw.
He didn't do that one though.
No, but.
No. He only did the other two movies. I know who Almighty. He is now. So, but yeah, Terror on Tour, because it also was in the 70s. This movie's from the 70s. This was made in the 80s. So this is probably towards because this guy.
Something you're yawning. Yeah, you're gonna make everyone right now is yawning right now. Listen,
because it's fucking Terror on Tour.
I wouldn't say it's a yawn-worthy one.
No.
It has its moments.
There is some yawn. Like the beginning is a lot of fun. Once the story starts to set up with the singers, like, you know, getting dressed and putting their makeup on, that works. However, right when the killing starts is kind of when it falls flat.
Mm-hmm.
But and doesn't really pick up until like the last, because I think the last 15 minutes are super strong.
Oh, dude, they're
gold. The last 15 minutes are great, and the ending to the movie is a lot of fucking fun because it's not traditional at all.
No, it's almost like,
wait a second, is it fucking over? Like, I don't understand.
In a traditional film, we would have had about 10 to 15 minutes more, you know, to basically tie it all up.
Yeah.
But they don't, and it's great. I think it's great for it. One thing I wonder, they got this makeup on, and they're just making out with chicks left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's...
That's what you do.
But these women are not getting black makeup all over their lips and white makeup all over their face and other areas.
Yeah, because they get the good shit.
Is this a special kind of makeup? Is there makeup that does that?
They're billionaires. They have billion-dollar makeup.
Okay.
If you get the good stuff, it doesn't come off.
I guess. Is that a thing? I mean, BJ is the expert. You're the stage performance expert.
Yeah, I'm currently doing this podcast, and I still have old age makeup on my show, and I'm trying to wipe it off, and I know that it's not going to happen.
But if you went in and just slobbered all over Zach right now, would it get off? Would it transfer to him?
It would still be on my face because you use a setting powder.
Okay.
Well, I recommend Ben Nye translucent powder. It's really good.
And you do see they're putting on makeup for like an hour and a half movie, right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know if that was just a budgetary thing.
Dude,
they're like,
always,
we gotta stretch this thing out.
They're always putting on makeup.
You know that this film was shot in 7 days, right? Because that's a thing.
Oh,
that's
really?
A real thing.
Wow.
Seven whole days.
It explains a lot because of kind of the there's a few scenes where it's like, hey, what's up? Oh, nothing. Going to this concert. How about you? Oh,
yeah.
I'm going to have fun. All right. See you later. And yeah. The scene ends, and it's like, what was the purpose?
It feels like we have this much battery life on this camera, guys. Yeah. We got to get this in and out.
Hey, my car broke down. You got the money, Yomi? No. But do you have the money for me? No, I don't got the money for me, for you. But why don't you get the money for me? As they're walking, you know, that went on for way too long. Scenes like that, yes.
All right, no, I agree. But that explains a lot. This movie was shot in 7 days.
Wow.
It really shows for...
And the four guys, I looked them up on IMDb afterwards, and they, like the four clowns, really haven't done anything since then. And by really haven't, I mean they literally have done nothing since then. So I don't know if they were just looking for musicians that could maybe act or how they found these guys, but they haven't done anything.
Well, the clowns are a real band. I mean, the clowns aren't a real band, but the people that played the clowns are a real band, correct? Isn't that what it is?
I don't know. I didn't get that far in my research. All I know is I was really psyched because the guy who plays Dave Cherry is who plays Cherry is named Dave Galuzzo, and I was like, hey, maybe you're related to Rob G. I don't know. Make him look through that family tree.
From a script perspective, did you guys get confused at all during this as far as how many guys there were putting on the clown makeup? Because, you know, guys was doing it to get chicks, as he says, because he's not good with ladies. So he puts on the makeup so he can wander around.
But that's Ferb.
Yeah, I think that becomes very similar to, you know, the latter Halloween films when everybody's wearing a Michael Myers mask.
Yeah.
I think
that would be five. That would be five people putting on makeup then.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, I guess I did get.
But then you see another guy who wants to do it too, and then there's possibly another guy. It's like all these clowns run around. I just had to hard time kind of following and then getting, you know, the explanation. I guess there really is no explanation. There's no why given in this, really, which I guess makes it great. I don't need a...
What are you talking about? The killer is?
The killer. Like, there's no big, like, revelation on, oh, here's why he's doing it. He's just a bit crazy. Right?
I mean...
No.
Unless I missed it.
That's, Brad... Would you like to school our friend here?
He has an issue with the girls and stuff like that, but I mean that's pretty much it. There's no big, you know, he doesn't get on a soapbox and explain why he's doing everything.
Well, no, I mean there's no like big big speaking scene, but I mean we're all like truly believe that it's, you know, Herb that's putting on the makeup and killing everybody, but in reality, spoiler alert, we have Tim. Who is his name's Tim, right? I believe his name's Tim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the manager is the one. But yeah, he's, you know, it's the reason why he's, you know, killing the girl. And he also, you know, he calls them filthy. He calls them sluts because, you know, you shouldn't go around and these people shouldn't have kids, blah, blah, blah.
No, I know. I mean, you don't really get that from him as the manager at all. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden it's crazy Tim.
Tim's always been crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm kind of confused of what you're saying that you didn't understand, though. Of, like, why he's doing it?
It's just, you know.
Is it because he never indicated it?
He's just crazy all of a sudden. Where in his scenes before, as manager Tim.
I think it just got to him because these guys are sleeping with... Because the thing is, they're killing the groupies.
Right.
These guys are putting on this makeup, putting on these shows, getting all this attention... banging all these chicks, and the manager just sits by and just lets it all happen. It's mainly out of jealousy, and
he
hates women.
Yeah, the way you got to think about it too is it's the Scooby-Doo reveal where there's a lot of creepy people going around, and then you're really focusing, thinking that it's one person, and then it ends up being the person that has indicated nothing, the person to some extent indicates that they're totally cool with this. Surprise, they're actually the bad guy. Scooby-Doo, what's up?
Well, that's what I was getting at. There's no, you know, it's not hinted really at all. It is a surprise, but it's...
Yeah, it's a Scooby-Doo ending. It's 101, man.
Awesome. So,
yeah.
I think it's fun. I'll probably never watch it again, but...
Yeah, it's a one-timer for sure. Great VHS cover, though.
Yeah, really cool.
but definitely a film that could use a decent release, because this movie really does look like shit.
Oh, don't worry. Code Red will release it for $30 next year, probably.
I really hope not.
That's what they've been doing. They've been they just announced Deadly Dreams.
Yeah, I know. We talked about.
I think that this would be a good suit for like a Vinegar Syndrome. I think they could probably do something cool with it.
Yeah.
I think it falls in their wheelhouse of weird stuff. And plus, like, if you're a fan of like the Ilsa films, like maybe they could wheel it in with that sort of directorial thing. I don't know. They do good work. They're
good boys. I think they can do it. This would be right in there. This would make sense with them for sure. Yep.
Yeah. No, I completely.
This is a movie that could possibly make a good remake.
I would agree with that.
Why don't you do it, Sean? Show us how remakes should be done.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because I have so much experience with filming.
And you can explain. You can explain why Tim wants to kill everybody.
I would. I would subtly do it though. So on your second watch, you're like, "Oh shit, I missed that," right?
So monologues.
No big speaking monologues, but you know,
you kind of missed everything in the movie because it's so fucking dark.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they had one light in this entire movie.
No,
they spent all their money on grease paint.
No, they must have spent money on that makeup.
That's awesome. All right, I don't have very much else to say about this movie.
Yep, me neither.
Okay, all right.
It's fun. It's heavy metal. It's clowns.
It's fully available on the YouTubes. If you want to go that route,
it's very expensive, probably on tape.
The VHS is, I looked it up, like $40, I think, at least. I could be wrong.
40?
It's a little.
40.
It's not worth $40.
VHS. Somebody said they saw a DVD on eBay, and I was like, that's a VHS rip bootleg.
Absolutely.
Because this never got a DVD release. So, but yeah, you know, I think if I mean, the movie itself, yeah, it is what it is, but if someone came along and made a really cool Blu-ray out of this with some really fun features, you know, it would be a buy. Not for $30.
I would love to hear about shooting this in 7 days.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's a documentary I would like to watch.
Totally. I think round everyone
up. The director is dead.
He's dead. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there's other people, enough people around that could still have some fun stories.
That would talk about the movie.
If you think about, like, shooting a film in 7 days, like, that is... Right there,
it's bonkers.
Is crazy, and there's got to be a ton of stories for, you know, because things get wild when you're moving it that quick.
Yeah.
All right, so that was Terror on Tour from 1980. Check it out if you want. All right, well, that's gonna do it for this week's show, you guys. Oh, are we gonna close on a downer? We're gonna close on a downer. Vanity.
You always do.
Vanity died.
I didn't want to open up with it. I don't want to, you know, but I mean, you know, Vanity.
Yeah, but you close with it.
The gorgeous Vanity. What was her real name?
I don't know, and I'm a dick for not knowing.
Denise Matthews.
Denise Matthews was her.
Yeah, she's had some health issues, some kidney issues and abdominal illness. And so she passed away at the time of this recording. On Monday, but she was 57, but it's a shame. But go check out her movies. Of course, we've talked about, you know, her most amazing movie already.
Yes.
Never Too Young to Die.
Never Too Young to Die.
The Last Dragon and Action Jackson. So make sure you find those. And she has been to some videos, right? She had her song Nasty Girl was
Prince for a while.
Prince. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So I mean, she's someone that I've known was around, but I didn't really, you know, until we started this podcast and you talked about Never Too Young to Die. And I looked up that scene I was immediately like, why didn't I pay attention to Vanity sooner?
But she's a beautiful girl.
Yep. So it's a shame. It's definitely a shame. So with that.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
Well, thank our sponsors, guys.
Yeah. We're gonna close out Heavy Metal Horror Month with, we'll do a drawing next week. I'll round up everyone who has sent me pictures of their transactions. So if you support any of our sponsors, if you support Tex Montana, their Kickstarter.
Yeah, support Tex Montana.
Please do.
There's only a few more days.
Make that your number one priority. If you're gonna spend something, spend it on Tex Montana. We'll survive. We'll have links in the show notes here, but it's also on Kickstarter. Just on Kickstarter.com, type in Tex Montana. You'll find it. Please donate to them. We would love to see this movie released next month. Also, Coffee Shop of Horrors. If you buy any coffee from them, make sure you use the code SCREAMCAST to get 10% off. GrindhouseVideo.com. Anything over $25, if you use the code SCREAMCAST10, you get 10% off. So if you send us any transactions from any of those, we will definitely put your name into the drawing. We'll do a drawing next week. And also inkspatters.com, Kevin Spencer. I believe he has some t-shirts and stuff still up on there.
And Wolfman of Mars.
And Wolfman of Mars. So if you buy Wolfman of Mars album, you buy anything from Kevin Spencer. God damn it, is it inkspatters.net?
You need to start writing things down.
I get them both confused. It's inkspatters.com. If you buy Wolfman of Mars has their vinyl coming out with Thumondo. It's a beautiful thing. So if you buy any of those things, let us know. Read me at thescreamcast.com. Send me a screenshot of the transaction. You'll be entered into the drawing. All right, I think that about does it. Of course, check us out at thescreamcast.com. That's our links to Twitter, Facebook, and all that shit on there. So with that said, we'll talk to all you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.
It's good. I told her, I go, you know, when you're a little bit older, you're not going to want to be sharing a room with boys, but whatever.
She will, just not her brothers.
Well, yeah. Touché.